Tonight's reading is taken from John's Gospel, chapter 9, from verses 1 to 41, and that can be found on page 1075 of the Church Bibles. John chapter 9, beginning at verse 1. As he went along, he saw a man blind from birth. His disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus. "But this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life. As long as it is day, we must do the work of him who sent me. Night is coming when no one can work. While I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said this, he spat on the ground, made some mud with the saliva, and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." This means sent. So the man went and washed, and came home seeing. His neighbours and those who had formerly seen him begging asked, "Isn't this the same man who used to sit and beg?" Some claimed that he was. Others said, "No, he only looks like him." But he himself insisted, "I am the man." "How then were your eyes opened?" they demanded. He replied, "The man they call Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. So he told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. They brought to the Pharisees the man who had been blind. Now the day on which Jesus had made the mud and opened the man's eyes was a Sabbath. Therefore the Pharisees also asked him how he had received his sight. "He put mud on my eyes," the man replied, "and I washed, and now I see." Some of the Pharisees said, "This man is not from God, for he does not keep the Sabbath." But others asked, "How can a sinner do such miraculous signs?" So they were divided. Finally, they turned again to the blind man. "What have you to say about him? It was your eyes he opened." The man replied, "He is a prophet." The Jews still did not believe that he had been born blind and received his sight, until they sent for the man's parents. "Is this your son?" they asked. "Is this the one you said was born blind? How is it that he now can see?" "We know he is our son," the parents answered, "and we know he was born blind. But how he can see now, or who opened his eyes, we don't know. Ask him. He is of age. He will speak for himself." His parents said this because they were afraid of the Jews, for already the Jews had decided that anyone who acknowledged that Jesus was the Christ would be put out of the synagogue. That was why his parents said, "He is of age, ask him." A second time they summoned the man who had been blind. "Give glory to God," they said. "We know this man is a sinner." He replied, "Whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I do know, I was blind, but now I see." Then they asked him, "What did he do to you? How did he open your eyes?" He answered, "I have told you already, and you did not listen. Why do you want to hear it again? Do you want to become his disciples too?" Then they hurled insults at him and said, "You are this fellow's disciple. We are disciples of Moses. We know that God spoke to Moses, but as for this fellow, we don't even know where he comes from." The man answered, "Now that is remarkable. You don't know where he comes from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." To this they replied, "You were steeped in sin at birth. How dare you lecture us?" And they threw him out. Jesus heard that they had thrown him out, and when he found him, he said, "Do you believe in the Son of Man?" "Who is he, sir?" the man asked. "Tell me so that I may believe in him." Jesus said, "You have now seen him. In fact, he is the one speaking with you." Then the man said, "Lord, I believe," and he worshipped him. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into this world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Some Pharisees who were with him heard him say this and asked, "What, are we blind too?" Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin, but now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains."
It would be a great help if you could keep a finger in that page in John 9. Western society finds religious belief somewhat perplexing these days. The social commentators tell us that we've all become so rootless and disillusioned that we've all gone postmodern. So they say that religious faith is now okay because anything goes. You can believe what you like. Any way of seeing or coping with life is as valid as the next. But despite that, when someone holds their hand up and says they do believe, our society shows its modern roots by scratching its head in disbelief as to how anyone could do such a thing. So from time to time here at St. Helens, journalists come along trying to understand why it is that workers in the city should want to give up a lunch hour to come to church on a Tuesday. Or, if you are a believer, you've probably seen the look of incredulity mixed with mild amusement when someone discovers you are a Christian. Well, fancy that, they're thinking, in this day and age. If we do believe, however, just as puzzling can be unbelief. Why is it that some of our friends, whom we long to know Christ, have no interest in him whatsoever? Maybe you invited someone to the Way, Truth and Life evenings we had recently, but they refused the invitation. Or perhaps they did come, but it made no impact whatsoever. Possibly they were even offended and vowed never to come again. So how do we react when people turn down what we clearly understand to be the good news of salvation? Why don't they get it? And what chance do they have of ever getting it? Well, this is very much the presenting issue that we find just before John chapter 9. It's the kind of backdrop for chapter 9. Over the last couple of weeks, we've seen Jesus in confrontation with God's historical people, the Jews, and their leaders. And in the broad sweep of biblical history, it should be a time of great fulfillment and wonder. The Messiah, the one whom God promised to send to his people in order to rescue them from their oppressors and establish an everlasting kingdom, he has arrived. After hundreds of years of waiting, he turns up in first century Palestine and starts demonstrating by miraculous signs that he is certainly the one that God has promised. And finally, he comes to God's people, to the ones to whom God made the promises in the first place. What a great time to be alive. And what happens? I look at chapter 8 and verse 59. They picked up stones to stone him. Well, they were probably the extremists, weren't they? Well, quite the opposite. If you look back to chapter 8 and verse 31 to see those he's with. To the Jews who had believed him, Jesus said, "If you hold to my teaching, you are really my disciples." So far from being militant fanatics, these Jews were the pick of the bunch, the ones who showed the most interest, the most promise. Yet they would not hold to his teaching. For when he said in verse 58, "I tell you the truth, before Abraham was born, I am," they picked up stones to stone him. So it is that I think we're supposed to come to chapter 9 with a certain amount of despair and lots of questions. Why can't God's people see it? Why can't the Jews see it? Why won't they believe? And if the Jews, if God's own people reject him, even those who showed the most promise, then how will anyone ever believe? Well, chapter 9 gives us the answer to that question. We are dependent on Jesus to open blind eyes. We are dependent on Jesus to open blind eyes. That is to say that it takes a miracle for someone to believe. All of the miracles in John's Gospel are supposed to teach us about Jesus. They're not just random power displays put on to impress the crowds. John calls them miraculous signs. They point to something. And this sign is very clear in what it points to. Jesus tells us right at the beginning of the chapter, As they threaten to stone him, Jesus heads away from the temple grounds, and he sees this blind man, and that prompts a question from the disciples. Why is he blind? Is he being punished for his sin? Or maybe for his parents' sin? Well, Jesus stops the speculation with an explanation of what is about to happen. Look at verse 3. He says, "Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." Now that phrase, the work of God, should make us prick up our ears, because Jesus had already told us what the work of God is. If you turn back to chapter 6 and verse 29, where Jesus is in discussion with the Jews, 6 verse 29, Jesus answered, "The work of God is this, to believe in the one he has sent." The point of the miracle is to show that it is Jesus who enables people to believe in him, the one God has sent. It is he alone who opens eyes to who he is. Now, I guess that on the surface, it's fairly obvious how the miracle makes that point. Jesus clearly opens the blind man's eyes, and then that man starts to believe in him. Case closed. But to really understand the significance of what is happening, we're going to look at the story from two angles, two perspectives. First, from the context of the whole Bible, and then from the content of the story itself. So first, the big picture. Jesus is doing what only God can do. Jesus is doing what only God can do. There seems to be a common misconception that the people who lived in the first century were altogether more credulous than we are these days when it comes to miracles. You know, that they were predisposed to believe anything supernatural, and the more unusual the better. You know, water into wine, why not? But when we actually look at the Gospels, that is not what we find at all. The man himself makes the point later in the story as he argues with the Pharisees. People know that this kind of incident just doesn't happen. So if you look at verse 32, the man says, "Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." It is unheard of for someone to open blind eyes. And if it does happen, the only conclusion you can reach is that God himself must be at work. And when we look back into the Old Testament, that is precisely what we are told. It is a distinctive activity of God. So I'm going to read a couple of verses. This is Exodus 4, verse 11. "Who gives man sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord?" Or Psalm 147 and verse 8. "The Lord sets prisoners free. The Lord gives sight to the blind." The activity of opening blind eyes is very much the domain of God himself. Yet also in the Old Testament, blindness has spiritual connotations. To be blind is to be separated from God, to be set in rebellion against him, to be under his judgment. And thus, when God promises to rescue his people, it is often described in terms of him giving sight to the blind. It would be worth seeing one example. So turn to page 719. That's Isaiah 35. Isaiah 35. Page 719. Isaiah 35, and we'll start at verse 4. Halfway through verse 4. "Be strong, do not fear. Your God will come. He will come with vengeance. With divine retribution, he will come to save you." Verse 5, "Then will the eyes of the blind be opened and the ears of the deaf unstopped." So this is the true significance of the sign. When Jesus turns up and opens the eyes of a man born blind, we're supposed to sit up and take notice. At the end of chapter 8, the Jews picked up stones to stone him because he referred to himself as "I am," the name that belonged to God alone. And they're outraged because he's claiming to be God. How can he say something so blasphemous? Well, chapter 9 answers the case completely, as Jesus does something of great biblical significance. He does something that only God can do. By opening the eyes of the blind, he confirms his identity as God himself, the light of the world who comes to rescue his people and to draw them to himself. So that is the big picture. Jesus does what only God can do. But the second thing to notice is seen in the story itself, and that is that Jesus gives real faith. The sign is not just a visual aid. It's not purely symbolic. Jesus doesn't just physically open the eyes of a blind man. He actually gives real faith, true belief. And the hallmarks of true faith can be seen throughout the chapter as the man's faith grows consistently, even under persecution. It would be worth seeing how it develops. So if you look at verse 11, the man refers to Christ just as the man they call Jesus. In verse 17, under inquisition from the Pharisees, he says he is a prophet. But as the pressure increases, his confidence and his understanding increases as well. So we find the Pharisees hurling insults at him in verse 28. But listen to his response. Verse 30, "You don't know where he came from, yet he opened my eyes. We know that God does not listen to sinners. He listens to the godly man who does his will. Nobody has ever heard of opening the eyes of a man born blind. If this man were not from God, he could do nothing." Now, what is so striking is that all of this is happening in Jesus' absence. The man doesn't see Jesus, seemingly, from the moment he's sent off to wash in the pool until he's thrown out of the synagogue when Jesus fully reveals his identity and he worships him. Yet the faith that the man is given grows and is able to withstand the full force of religious authority and persecution. And that is real God-given faith. Far from being a psychological crutch, people say that, don't they, that it's a psychological crutch, but real faith grows and flourishes under hardship and persecution. Now, this has been seen in the church historically many times. I think most famously this century in communist China. In 1949, when the Western missionaries were kicked out, there were 3 million Christians, approximately, in China, and we all trembled, thinking that they would be doomed without us. But by 1993, when they were able to go back, it had grown to about 50 million. During that time, Wenzhou City was selected as a model for the campaign for renouncing religion. But now it is the most Christian city in China. So what are we to learn from this miraculous sign? Well, we must depend on Jesus to do what only he can do. Only he can open blind eyes. Only he can enable someone to believe. And furthermore, if he does so, the faith that he gives is not an insubstantial thing. It will grow and last and be able to stand in the face of the greatest opposition. Well, the implications of this are huge, aren't they? Let's return to the questions that we were asking at the beginning. How is it that anyone ever comes to believe? How can those who seem so hostile to the gospel ever acknowledge who Jesus is? Well, the answer given here is that it can only happen through a miracle, through Jesus opening their eyes. Now, this may come as a surprise to you, but fundamentally, it is not down to us. We're told that each of us has a responsibility to turn to Christ, but no amount of reasoning through the issues or good works and no amount of effort on our part will bring ourselves or anyone to Christ unless he opens their eyes. Now, it may be that you wouldn't call yourself a Christian at the moment. It's great you can be with us tonight. Anyone is always welcome to join us. Maybe you're just looking in to see what it's all about. Maybe you want to believe, but don't feel as though that you can. Well, let me say that if you are going to come to know Christ as your Saviour and Lord, don't underestimate what has to happen. You may feel as though it's all up to you. You may feel as though you just have to convince yourself. Or maybe you just have to summon up the will or the courage to go for it. But actually, nothing will happen unless Jesus opens your eyes. Because only he can do it. Only God opens blind eyes. And therefore, my only advice to you will be to ask him to do that miracle if you want to believe. In other words, pray to him. Ask for his help. Now, if we're Christian, of course, this means that we shouldn't think too much of ourselves, doesn't it? Our belief is no testimony at all to our achievement. It was all the work of God. But the same lesson must apply in the case of our friends when we're thinking of them. Now, of course, we are going to do all we can to explain and persuade them of the truth of the gospel. And that's right, that is our job. But it is critical that we don't think we can ever enable someone to believe. It's very easy to get into that mindset, isn't it? To think that ultimately everything hangs on us and on our efforts. But ultimately, Jesus alone can open their eyes. And so as much as anything else, we need to pray that he would do that work. And if he does, we can be sure that that new faith will grow and it will survive. So let me ask, are you praying regularly for your friends? It's a very simple thing, isn't it? But if you're not, well, is that because in some way you think that it's down to you? Well, why not work out a way that you can pray for your friends regularly? Find out a manageable system that works for you. Because only Jesus can open their eyes. And so it's a bit daft if we don't ask him to do what only he can do. So we're dependent on Jesus to open blind eyes. But that's not the end of the story. It's certainly not the end of this story in John 9. Because as the blind man's eyes are opened, and he steadily acknowledges more and more of who Jesus is, a different reaction is also being held up for us to see. And that is the reaction of the Jews, and in particular the Pharisees. So let's turn back and trace the development of their response. In verse 16, we see that they are divided. They come to investigate, but they're divided. Some say he's breaking the Sabbath, but others can't ignore what he's done. In verse 22, however, we see that maybe they're not so open-minded after all. They had already made up their mind to eject from the synagogue those who acknowledged him. In verse 24, they say, "We know this man is a sinner." And then from verses 28 to 34, they actually turn on and persecute this new believer. There's an increasing hostility to Jesus and to those who follow him. And what is so disturbing is that the greater the evidence put before them, the more and more it is confirmed that this has definitely happened, the more stubbornly and furiously they refuse to accept it. So what's going on? What explanation do we have for the unfolding events? Well, look at verse 39, where Jesus tells us how to interpret. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into the world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Jesus is making a sobering point. If we don't depend on him, we will be blinded. If we don't depend on him, we will be blinded. In the same way that sight is given to the blind man, it is taken away from the Pharisees as they are made increasingly unable to believe. And Jesus is responsible for both. Now, we react against this, don't we? We perhaps like the idea that Jesus came to open eyes and to give life, but we balk at the thought that he came to blind in judgment. Yet this is exactly what Jesus himself tells us. This is from John chapter 5, verses 21 and 22. "Just as the Father raises the dead and gives them life, even so the Son gives life to whom he is pleased to give it. Moreover, the Father judges no one, but has entrusted all judgment to the Son. We may not like it, but actually it is further confirmation of his identity too. Do you remember that verse that we looked at from Exodus 4? Well, listen again. Who gives man sight or makes him blind? Is it not I, the Lord? And when in Isaiah 6 God judges his rebellious people, he puts it like this. Be ever hearing but never understanding. Be ever seeing but never perceiving. Make the heart of this people calloused. Make their ears dull and close their eyes. So Jesus came not only to open eyes, but also to blind. Well, now it's worth pausing for a moment and asking whether we fully recognise this fact about him. Or let me put it in the form of a question. Does our understanding of who Jesus is match this description of him? We easily accommodate the idea of a Jesus who actively reaches out to save and rescue. But do we also acknowledge that he actively steps in to judge as well? Hardening hearts, blinding eyes. I wonder whether you've ever had the experience of being misrepresented. I had a tutor at university who spent 10 minutes once telling me that my philosophy essays were suffering because of my narrow evangelical faith. And he completely missed the point. My essays were poor because I wasn't doing any work. But all of us will have had some sort of experience of being misrepresented. You know, the school report that did no justice to the effort that you put in. Or the rumour about you that you hear going around that bears no relation to the facts whatsoever. We hate being misrepresented. Well, how much more the Son of God? It's a serious business to embrace one aspect of his character, but to reject another. None of us like being treated like that. And we can't treat Jesus like that. Jesus said, "For judgment I have come into the world, so that the blind will see, and those who see will become blind." Jesus came to judge the hard-hearted. And that is exactly what we see happening to the Pharisees. They are being blinded by him. Now, this may seem to raise a problem. If Jesus blinded the Pharisees, does that imply that they could see in the first place? And if that's true, does that mean that he will blind us who can see now? Well, no. Jesus clarifies as he goes on. The Pharisees hear him speaking to the formerly blind man and ask in verse 40, "What, are we blind too?" And Jesus said, "If you were blind, you would not be guilty of sin. But now that you claim you can see, your guilt remains." Their crime is to claim that they can see. In other words, they are judged for the complacency that has been so evident throughout the last few chapters. Jesus' diagnosis has been very clear. Jesus says that they are slaves to sin, that they need to be set free, that they do not belong to God, but they need to believe in him to have life. And yet they refuse to listen. They say they don't need to be set free, that they are children of Abraham and children of God. They're disciples of Moses, they say to this man. And they ignore the clear evidence of the miraculous signs that point to Jesus' identity. They're claiming that they can see, that they don't need him. And as a result, their guilt remains as they are blinded in judgment. Well, if this chapter contains the great news that Jesus can open blind eyes, it also has a solemn warning against this kind of complacency. Over the last couple of weeks, we've been hearing about Jesus' diagnosis of the normal human, condition of the human heart. And the news is about as bad as it could get. He's told us that there is nothing we can do in and of ourselves to make ourselves children of God. Our spiritual condition is fatal, and we are powerless to change it. Or to put it another way, we are spiritually bankrupt. We have nothing to offer God to make ourselves worthy of him. We are, Jesus says, slaves to sin, prisoners of our own rebellion against God, and destined to die in our sins. Yet he's also told us the necessary treatment. He says we need to come to him, to listen to him, to be set free and to be saved. Well, I wonder how you've been responding to what Jesus teaches. Here are some possibilities. You may have dismissed it all, thinking, well, it's just not true. You know, we're not all that bad. Surely most of us are sufficiently compassionate and sensitive and responsible to ultimately find favour in God's eyes. Or you may go even further and feel sure of your credentials, being sure that you are worthy of being one of God's children. Well, if that is our response, we are playing with fire, because we are saying that we know better than Jesus. We know better than the one who does what only God can do. We're effectively saying that we can see. And Jesus says he has come in judgment, that those who see in that way will become blind. His verdict in verse 41, now that you claim you see, your guilt remains. If that is our position, Jesus will blind us in judgment such that we will not be able to believe and be saved. It sounds really harsh, doesn't it? But actually, it's exactly what we deserve. We are saying to him that we have no need, and so he takes away our ability to see it. He makes us entirely self-sufficient. But the only problem is that our guilt remains, and according to Jesus, we will die in our sins. Well, my guess is that there will be some here who are in that position thinking that they make the mark to be one of God's children, but I suppose that most of us won't. It might be, though, that your response to Jesus' diagnosis is basically positive. Yes, we know we're not perfect. We know that we need his help and forgiveness. But what about now? Of course, he made us children of God in the first place. But surely now we keep our place in the family by the way that we live out our lives. Let me ask you a question. As you look back over the course of a week, what things increase your confidence that you are one of God's children? Regular quiet times, maybe. The opportunity to talk to friends about Christ. Serving God's people elsewhere or here at St. Helens or in RML. Well, if I'm honest, I know that these are the things which make me feel good about my faith. If I can see these things in my day-to-day life, then I feel more like one of God's children. But there is a significant danger there. If we are thinking along these lines, we are being tempted to depend upon ourselves. These good and important things are taking the focus of our trust away from Christ and onto us. We are beginning to say that we have no need. In other words, we are starting to claim that we can see. And Jesus says that's a dangerous claim, for if it gets into our bloodstream and we really start to believe it, we will be blinded and our guilt will remain. There's no fence to sit on. If we're not fully depending on him, then we're claiming we have no need. But according to him, we will face him in judgment. And so it's vital that we ask ourselves, are we fully depending on Christ to be children of God? Because only he can do it. Only he can enable us to believe. Only Jesus can open blind eyes and give real faith that will grow and will survive.